The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
The recording. Okay, great. So welcome to today. And I'd like to just start us off with a review of what we had offered as possibilities for contemplation this week. So you were given the MN48, the principles of cordiality, or I believe Ajahn Sujato called them warm-hearted qualities, to look at in this sutta about the monks that were disputing, and the Buddha told them how they could get along better. And then in addition, there was a suggested reflection of looking at how you show up in groups. And, you know, whether you're open, caring, flexible, generous, but also able to maintain independence of thought within the group. So we'd love to know if you have any comments or questions or anything about your exploration this week of ethics and relationship in regards to living a Dharma life. And you can either just raise your hand or you can raise your blue hand.
Formerly blue hands. Right now we all have yellow or different colors. We have different.
My hands are pretty blue because it's really cold here today. Okay, Morgan, I saw your hand first.
Hi, this was so interesting to me. It has been so interesting to me with, the whole Zoom thing and sitting back and taking time in my interactions. And in the Gil did Andrea did a Concord, Living in Concord series. And he shared something about, it said give up looking for flaws in others, give up sly implications, give up criticizing, give up persisting and finding fault, don't seize on trivial mistakes. It all comes down to self-criticism. And I was using that in Zoom interactions to watch my mind in how I do make little judgments. They're like microaggressions, and that it's just a habit of mine. And it's about me feeling better about myself in my conditioning coming up through school and everything. And so in Zoom, I can sit back and just watch my mind. And then I've been doing replacing a microaggression with a micro kindness. So every time I see a microaggression arise in my mind, I send metta back out. I'm so grateful to be able to see this because it was all unconscious. And what I leave with a smile on my face from these meetings, that once I had this unpleasant feeling, it's now I'm seeing what's happening in my mind and changing direction. And it's so amazing. I can't even. So thank you for this exercise. And I combined that and it's just been very rich.
Okay. Well,
long share.
Wow. Well, thank you for your clarity in describing that so clearly, right? And so there's the seeing, and then if you want, you can turn it around into this micro-kindness, as you called it. That would be in line with MN48 of, you know, mental acts of loving kindness toward others. It's also fine just to see it and to let it kind of dissolve in the seeing. Those are both really good approaches. So thank you for sharing that. I don't know if you want to add anything, Diana. No, okay. Chris.
Just that, wow, Morgan, that, like, whoa, I'm just like bubbling with what you just said. And I was going to offer out similar to what you just said, but added on, I kind of lose my independence of thought when we get in our groups. I start with a thought, and as we move around the group, the next person's thought becomes my thought. And the next person, I sort of like, they're speaking for me in the group, and I discover more about my thought. So I don't feel independent. In fact, it's very Sangha inducing, these, especially on Zoom, since we're just sort of being tossed in a group very quickly and we're looking at each other's faces, and it's like, okay, you first, what? Oh, well, and we're kind of speaking off the tops of our minds too. So it's really quite wonderful. So that was sort of, I was just answering to this idea of independence of thought and what sort of happens. Right now it's sort of, I'm feeling very independent because I'm so alone now due to the virus. You know, I'm not going out in the world so much. So anyway, that's all I can offer out.
Yeah, observation of the mind will inevitably lead us to realize how conditioned our thoughts and mind states are. You know, they're really built out of the stuff that's been coming in. And this is depressing sometimes, but also kind of liberating because, yeah. And so just seeing that, yeah, beautiful. Anything else, Diana? No? Okay. I see some hands. Stephen.
Hi, everybody. So thanks for the assignment. This is something that I have been trying to work on, because I've noticed that in these Zoom meetings that I generally tend to feel a lot more comfortable in a smaller group than in a larger group. And like right now, I shouldn't feel uncomfortable at all because Risa is here, and I've known Risa for a number of years. And, you know, so thank you for being here. I have, I felt good about some progress that I made today, and I'd just like to share about this. I do a couple of weekly classes in Dhamma with a group in the United Kingdom. I study and do tutorials with Peter Harvey every week, who's a British scholar of Buddhism. And I meet with him independently for a tutorial once a week. And then we have a class that usually meets once a week as well. And yeah, there are maybe, I guess, 12 students in the class. We're from 7 different countries. And today there was a man who spoke about his experience, the experience of his friends bombing, you know, by the United States in the country where he lived, and the violence that, you know, I mean, as a result of all of that. And it was kind of quite a scene. And he and I had a talk that, I don't know, maybe it was 10 minutes or so. I spoke about something that I normally don't speak with people about too much. I witnessed a terrorist attack when I was working overseas in the Philippines a number of years ago. A busload of students were out on dates on Valentine's Day in the Philippines in 2005. Abu Sayyaf had planted a bomb on the bus. It exploded, killed 10 students, 100 persons were injured. And this occurred 3 blocks from where I was staying. And a close friend of mine, who was actually on the way to see me, was 2 cars behind and thankfully survived the attack. And so we had this long discussion in class about, you know, about violence and about greed, hatred, and delusion, and history and the Buddhist teachings and how they can help humanity purify the mind and address the human suffering that is so prevalent in our world. And, you know, there was a lot of emotion shared in the class, and I was just so touched by, and I'm not trying to brag or anything, but this is something like today that really meant a great deal to me. There was a young woman in the class who sent a private chat to me during the class, and she said, what did she say? You know, she said, she's Jewish. And she said, thank you very much for sharing such painful experiences and articulating so well how loving kindness can help. And it just, you know, it just, it made me feel really touched that she would make the effort to do that, and that by speaking honestly and openly about our practice and about our lives, how we can help one another, you know. And I kind of think that's really part of the message of the sutta and of the assignment. I mean, I hadn't studied this one before, but I mean, wow, it's really, really a good one. And I saw also that Bhikkhu Bodhi has online, you can find his lectures on this one too. So I'm going to take a look at that this week in conjunction with the other things we're doing. So thanks for letting me share.
Thank you for sharing. That's so beautiful, Stephen. Just the fact that if we just open up and express the Dharma as it flows through us, as it was real in our life, it automatically has a connecting and healing effect. That's what I hear in what you say. Of course, there's much more, but I'll just say that.
Thank you. I also want to say thank you, Stephen. Maybe one thing I will add, sometimes maybe we're not even noticing how we're expressing the Dharma or experiencing the Dharma until we turn to look at it and say, oh yeah, I've been doing this so long, I don't even recognize it as something that I learned in the teachings. Whether it's transforming a microaggression into micro-kindness, like Morgan said, or if it's like how you're talking about, Stephen, kind of this connecting with others, or as Chris talked about, like, oh yeah, maybe I'm not so as independent as I was thinking. So it's often we don't even recognize these things until we look at them or asked or given some homework assignment or something like this. Thank you. Thank you for sharing.
Well, maybe that's a good note to go on then. So today I'll just say that in line with our kind of continuing the main training areas in Buddhism, we talked about ethics in relationship kind of in the realm of sila, a different way of talking about sila. And so today we're going to talk about the realm of samadhi. And in that we're including the heart practices. So samadhi and heart is a topic for today. And Diana has some things to start us off with.
Thank you, Kim. Yeah, sila, samadhi, panya. Ethics, mental development, wisdom, that's one way we can translate this. And what I love is what you guys, those of you who have shared already, and maybe those of you who haven't shared have noticed this too, that there is a line between behaving ethically and the conditions in our mind. And we could even say towards concentration. In fact, the Buddha has a direct line between behaving ethically, helping create the conditions for concentration. And I'm using this word concentration, samadhi, doesn't necessarily mean, you know, we're up into the 28th jhana or anything like this. We could understand it as just having a little bit more collectedness, a little bit more non-distraction, a little bit more settledness. So when I use this word concentration, we can just use it in a really broad definition. So this line that the Buddha draws from ethics to concentration to samadhi, if we want to call it a line, it involves the heart and it involves the body, and it travels through gladness, joy, and happiness. So just a recognition that first, gladness, joy, and happiness are an integral part of practice. Sometimes we might be tempted to think like, okay, that's an ancillary thing. That's like, okay, maybe it's a fun little side effect or a pleasurable side effect. But actually, it's an integral part of practice, and it's connected to ethics, and it's connected to concentration. So ideas of gladness, joy, and happiness. And just like there is this spectrum, when I'm saying the word concentration, we can understand it as a really broad definition of concentration. In the same way, when I use words gladness or joy or happiness, we can think of that also as a really broad spectrum. So maybe it's just a subtle lightness of delight, like, oh, something like this. Or maybe it's this huge, rapturous, energetic, overpowering experience, right? It can be a really wide range there. And different people, different times, different stages in our practice, we experience it at different times in different ways. And maybe it's just a moment, maybe it's sustained, but however it shows up, all of these occurrences have value. All these occurrences of gladness, joy, and happiness. And maybe I'll just say this, that even the thought, thinking about gladness, joy, and happiness, and that might even incline the mind towards a little bit more spaciousness, a little bit less being stuck, a little bit more open. And just that movement of the mind is, you know, helps create the conditions for more concentration. So there's a sutta quote that I'm going to talk about a little bit. It's Gudra Nikaya 10.1. And in this one, it's kind of for me, I find it a little bit amusing that Ananda and the Buddha are having a conversation. So I don't know if this was an actual conversation that happened. If it were, that Ananda has been a little bit like maybe a three-year-old that says, yeah, but why? Yeah, but why? Yeah, but why? You know, it's all kind of this type of a thing. Or maybe it's just a pedagogical technique. We don't have to worry and figure that out right now. But there's a certain rhythm to this sutta. So Ananda goes to the Buddha and asks him, what is the purpose and what is the benefit of skillful ethics? Like, why should we behave ethically? And the Buddha replies, Ananda, the having no regrets is the purpose and benefit of skillful ethics. And for any of us who have ever had regrets, that alone is a reason enough to behave ethically, right? Having regrets is so painful. It's really painful. Having no regrets is the purpose and benefit of skillful ethics. But what's the purpose and benefit of having no regrets? Gladness is the purpose and benefit. But what's the purpose and benefit of gladness? Joy is the purpose and benefit. But what's the purpose and benefit of joy? Tranquility. But what's the purpose and benefit of tranquility? Happiness. But what's the purpose and benefit of happiness? Concentration. So this movement of behaving ethically, having no regrets, and then gladness, joy, tranquility, happiness, concentration. This is just this movement of the mind and the movement of the body too, right? Tranquility we can think of as a settling of the body, whereas happiness is often also a settling of the mind. So there's this group of five elements that we see: gladness, joy, tranquility, happiness, concentration. Sometimes we call this the gladness pentad. These five show up in this five order, and there's a certain amount of flowing that happens from one to the next. But before I talk more about this flowing, I'll just talk about it a little bit. So gladness is maybe a little bit of delight, and sometimes it's called the bliss of blamelessness, because it's tied to this idea of, you know, behaving ethically, this sense of knowing that one's behavior there will be no regrets and no shame or nothing to feel bad about. And then joy, the joy we can describe in a number of different ways. But one way we might think about it here is this this joy that arises that when we practice in the wholehearted way, like, yes, I'm going to do this, not straining and not overly ambitious, like we have to get somewhere, but delightfully engaged with the practice. This is a way in which there might be this energetic uplifting feeling. It can be a type of joy. And then also giving ourselves over to the practice in this full way also brings some relaxation and some ease, some tranquility, as the sources of stress begin to disappear because we're not thinking about them. We're thinking about the practice and all the different elements of the practice. And this can show up as sutta study or chanting or meditation or having some inquiry. It can show up in different ways. And then this relaxation in the body helps create the conditions for happiness. This deep sense of well-being and contentment. And then this deep sense of well-being and contentment creates a condition for concentration. So many people, and certainly me earlier in my practice, I definitely, when I heard the word concentration, I thought that it certainly involved a lot of straining and striving and working really hard. And it wasn't until I accidentally kind of like stumbled into some well-being, kind of by giving up, like, oh, gee, I'm exhausted. I have a headache. I'm going to back off a little bit, and realizing, oh, here's where the mind is able to kind of like settle down. So this is one way in which happiness and joy and tranquility and gladness really are an integral part of our practice, is that they help support settling of the mind. So one interest, there's another sutta that continues on this this theme. And the Buddha says, an ethical person need not make a wish, may I have no regrets. It's only natural that an ethical person will have no regrets. And when you have no regrets, you don't need to make a wish, may I feel gladness. It's only natural that gladness springs up when you have no regrets. And when you feel gladness, you need not make a wish, may I experience joy. It's only natural that joy arises. And then the sutta goes on. When you have joy, it's only natural that tranquility arises. And when you have tranquility, it's only natural that happiness arises. And when you have happiness, it's only natural that concentration arises. So pointing to this kind of like flowing of the practice. So to be sure, it started with being ethical, right? And that does require some effort. That does require some application, absolutely. But one way that I think about this is that it's like a slide that we might find in the playground, that we have to like walk up the ladder. But then we get to a certain place, we just slide down. So if we can help create the conditions and put forth some effort, also to not be striving and straining, but to allow this kind of natural process to unfold. So this is part of the art of practice, right? Is to know when to put in effort and when to just be allowing things to be unfolding. In the same way, and the Buddha has a number of similes about this. The of hens sitting on eggs. You know, whether the hen wants these eggs to hatch or not, if the hen is sitting on the eggs will hatch. In the same way, if we do these practices, we'll be moving towards awakening. And in the same way, water flows downhill. It goes from raindrops to rivulets to streams to rivers to the ocean. In the same way, behaving ethically helps create the conditions for George, maybe we might think of the concentration as the ocean, as you know, water flowing downhill. And in the same way, farmers plant plants, but farmers don't make the plants grow. It's just natural that plants grow. So I appreciate all these kind of natural similes. kind of pointing to that it's not so much up to us to make everything happen. And maybe I might point to that this is part of the art of practice too, right? Is to notice when there's a little bit too much striving, too much selfing, dare I say, when we feel like I have to make this happen. So in this sutta, these two suttas that we talked about, it was ethical conduct and then not having regret that helped to start this cascade of gladness, joy, tranquility, happiness, and concentration. But there's other suttas that have other ways to begin this cascade. So some is faith, or suffering kind of leads to faith, which then leads to gladness, and then the cascade goes. Or sometimes it's unwavering confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So we can see there's these heart qualities that also that really help support this flow to concentration. And guarding the senses leads to an unsoiled mind, which also leads to gladness, or abandoning the hindrances. So a number of these things that do require some effort help create the conditions in which this movement towards concentration might happen. And then maybe I'll say that also in a number of different suttas, what happens after concentration is a little bit different in some of these different suttas. But for the most part, there's this general movement of being able to see clearly, which then leads to some letting go, which then leads to awakening. So we can see that this these heart practices, maybe not the Brahma Viharas in the way that we often think about heart practices, but this different way of engaging, maybe a little bit more heartfelt, or maybe even a touch of devotion, if I dare say that word. Sometimes we like to think about things being scientific or something like this. But also, right, there's something in our heart that sings with this practice. And that can help support this movement too. So with that as a introduction, talking about this, now we'd like to put you into some breakout groups. And maybe I'll say in these breakout groups, just a reminder, you all know this, but just a reminder, you don't need to give advice to each other. And we don't need to correct people or, you know, anything like this, right? It's more an opportunity for us to connect with ourselves. And we're creating the conditions, that is, you have to speak. And that's a way in which you have to kind of like organize your thoughts. And maybe, you know, ask yourself, yeah, what do I think about this? And so it's a listening practice, very much a listening practice, and connecting to yourself. As well as connecting to others, of course, but just it's a little bit different than the conventional way that we have conversations. That this is a little bit more contrived, and you have a specific topic and the way that we'll introduce it. Okay, so with that as the background about like how to do this, some of what we can say is, I didn't spend a lot of time delineating the difference between gladness, joy, and happiness. And for the purposes of this, we can just maybe lump them together. And maybe you might use words like well-being, or maybe just happiness or something like this. So for this question, what is your relationship to happiness, joy, gladness, delight, well-being, okayness? I'm using a whole slew of words. Choose your favorite. What is your relationship to this with regard to practice? Do you think like you're a little bit dismissive? Like, I don't need that happiness stuff. I got to get somewhere and that's just getting in my way. Or do you have this feeling like, oh, this is the whole purpose of practice. It's the only way I do practice is to find these things. Or maybe you're not clear. I don't know. I never really thought about it. So just an opportunity to explore. What is your relationship to gladness, joy, and happiness? And how might it be supportive for your life and your practice? Maybe you've already discovered that it is, and if it isn't, how might you imagine that it could be supported? So what is your relationship? Maybe that'll be question one. And then second part is, how might it be supportive for your life, your Dharma life, and your practice? So we'll do this in groups of four, three or four, and we'll have about 12 minutes. And we'll go in order, because sometimes there's awkwardness in these groups, like who's going to go first? I don't want to go first. Does anybody else want to go first? And you spend half the time trying to negotiate who's going to go. So we'll go by the first digit of your house number. So if you live in 100 Main Street, you're probably going to go first. If you live in 999 Elm Street, you'll probably go last, right? So the first digit of the house number where you live. And as I said, the first time is your relationship to happiness, and one, how you might imagine it might be supportive. And you don't have to say everything that you know about this. Just say one or two things. And as you hear other people, as Chris shared in the introduction, you might discover that people are saying things that you might have said also. Okay, so with that as a long preamble, maybe Kim will send us off and to the breakout rooms. She has the magic keys. Thank you.
Okay, welcome back. That looks like everyone. So any comments, questions? We'd love to hear about your relationship to happiness and how it can support you. Or maybe you learned something from someone else, or you were surprised by something. Arlene, are you? Oh, no, you weren't. Okay.
Nobody has. Oh,
there's Anita.
Yeah, we had a great discussion ranging from effortful striving and learning to relax in the gladness, and how metta also contributes to gladness. But most of all, I wanted to thank you both, Kim and Diana. This is so beautiful. When you mentioned heart practices, I was waiting for the Brahma Viharas, and I love them too, but just to sort of introduce this pentad and focus on that, it's just, I mean, this is so beautiful. It really touched me deeply. Thank you.
Thank you, Anita.
And Bess.
Hi, I just want to take this opportunity to, again, thank both of you and the other teachers of IMC. I have a really great relationship with happiness, and I totally credit that to my showing up at IMC and trying to listen and integrate what you say into my life. So I just want to say thank you. And that's it.
Great. Thank you. Beautiful to hear.
Yeah, it's very nice. Very nice. Thank you, Bess.
David.
Hi, we had a good discussion in our group as well. And just a thought that's arisen since we were talking in the group is that I wonder if happiness is a kind of energy that sustains the practice. It's nice to feel, to focus on how the relation between happiness and the practice works. I think sometimes I'm so focusing on what I'm averse to or what my mind is seizing on that sometimes things like ease and happiness can be the subtext that I don't actually pay attention to. And yet there is a motivation to continue practice. And I think part of that is the faith in knowing that there is a residual happiness which can underlie the practice. But it's interesting to work with this on a conscious level, because a lot of the time I don't know if I give it... give it space, honestly. I think sometimes it's what maintains things, but I don't really focus on it that much. So I think this is a helpful discussion point and a helpful meditation. So thanks to both of you and to the group. So
lovely. Yeah, you mentioned energy. And when you said that, I thought about how in the seven factors of awakening, you have energy as the third one, and then that moves into joy, tranquility, concentration, part three of the Pentad. So it does underlie these positive mind states.
And maybe I'll just add that I've discovered that even with these experiences of happiness are really subtle, and there's a whole bunch of things that are happening that are not happiness, we still can incline our mind that direction, right? Of course, you know, we have these Four Noble Truths about suffering and all this, and so we tend to not maybe pay attention to them, but even when they're subtle and just a minor part of our experience, I think it's worthwhile to tune in, so to speak, to them.
Other comments? Chris?
I think the sciences show that when you decrease your adrenaline with this breathing very slowly and concentrating your breath, your parasympathetics rise, your oxytocin rises. It gives you the collectability of just being able to be stable and feel very comfortable, which we all want, right? I want to be uncomfortable. I don't want to be uncomfortable. And it allows me to kind of see my reactivity, because as I'm in that stable sort of quelling, sort of expansive state, when those thoughts do arise of old arguments, regrets, problems I've caused, it gives me the ability to watch that thought and not react to it in my normal pattern. Adrenaline, when your brain shoots adrenaline, your brain goes straight to the adrenals and shoots it. It's really fast. Parasympathetics take a little while to zip in, get the oxytocin going. Sometimes reaching in the middle of your chest and just breathing into that way will allow it to happen. I probably said this a million times. I use it as a nurse a lot when I have panicky patients, and myself too. And it, in that stable state of concentrative unified state, you're able to sort of reveal these reactive sort of thoughts you're having or emotional states. And it just gives you the little space, so you're not hooked by it and get pulled. You may get hooked by it and you may go on and thoughts about it for 5 minutes, and then you break away from it and go, oh, I'm having a you used to say I'm having a lousy meditation. Now you say, wow, look at that. Look how I was able to deal with that. That's all I was going to say. I don't know.
Nice. Thank you.
I think something that's important, that what Chris is pointing to also, is just the integration of physiology, psychology, right? It's not like we can just pull out one element. And the beauty of that, right, is we can jigger, so to speak, you know, one aspect and it affects the other, right? You can calm the body and it helps calm the mind. Or maybe you can calm the mind and it helps calm the body too. Yeah. Thank you.
Catherine.
I was noticing that I remember a guided meditation that you gave one time, Kim, and the it was to notice, now you're not feeling ill will, hostility, greed in this meditation. Notice how that feels. And I've been using that a lot. It makes it made a lot of difference to me. And now I'm feeling really inspired that the happiness that I feel in meditating and sitting, I'm noticing that I'm being happier, but I can actually use that to notice the happiness of meditation, and when off the cushion, to notice the joy of living, which just happens.
That's great. We can think of these as positive states that we cultivate, or they're what's naturally there when we don't have great hatred and delusion, essentially, but also ill will, hostility, all the manifestations of those. So a presence or an absence, either way works. Thanks. We could have one more. If anyone is so inclined. Phyllis.
I can say for myself, my relationship has certainly done a dramatic change in my door to the Dhamma was, I think, very much through aversion, to the point where I think I was sharing with my small group that I actually felt an aversion to things like happiness and joy, being unskillful, and sort of like equating them with clinging. Through just sort of the practice, it just kind of serendipitously kind of started seeping into my bones, this kind of feeling of these feelings of positive moments of joy, of ease, of tranquility, calm. And then by noticing these qualities, I just realized how helpful they were in terms of clarifying the mind and just really helping in terms of understandings. And so then it in turn really fit into something that I was lacking, which was faith and confidence in the practice. And so, I've really come to sort of appreciate that relationship in a whole different way.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah. Another bit of evidence that everything's all connected together and that these states kind of pull in other ones in whatever proportion we need to correct whatever we started with. Beautiful. I don't know if Diana wants to add anything. No. Okay, well then, we've been sitting for a while. Why don't we have a little break? Let's come back at 5 after the hour. It's about 8 minutes. See you then.